Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Pretty good, thanks, Tom. Hello, listeners.
Hello, listeners, and hello to our returning very special guest, Matthew Lesh. Matthew is a public policy fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs, as well as being a country manager at Freshwater Strategy. How are you doing, Matt?
Thanks for having me back.
Not at all. We've got plenty to talk about today. But before we do that, Chris, we should also give one final plug for the Battle of Ideas. This podcast, the Last Orders podcast, is going to be at the Battle of Ideas Festival in Westminster in a couple of weekends' time. On the Saturday, the 19th of October, we'll be in the Robert Runcie Room at 12:15 for a fantastic live show.
Nice big room, I bet.
Nice big room. We're very keen to fill it. So if you're going to the Battle of Ideas, please come to this session. We've got a very special guest, Julia Hartley Brewer, Simon Evans.
Wow.
And Kate Andrews.
What a lineup.
What a lineup indeed.
Diggity.
So if you want to come along to that.
You're not going to want to miss that, are you, listeners?
Absolutely. So if you are coming to Battle of Ideas, ignore every other session in that time slot and come to this one in the Robert Runcie
room. Be a viewer, not a listener.
Viewer, not a listener, of course. This one will actually be filmed as well, so people can see us
Don't tell them that. They won't bother coming.
This one you can only see or listen to if you come in.
We're not even going to put it out as a podcast. Exclusive.
It's kind of a sort of Chatham House
rules.
Too hot
for TV. hear what we really think.
So please do come along. If you haven't already got a ticket to the Battle of Ideas Festival, go to battleofideas.org.uk. And if you want to get a discount, all Spike fans and readers and listeners can do so. You get 20% off with the discount code SPIKED24. That's SPIKED24. You can get a day ticket for the Saturday just to see Last Orders and many other panels. Or why not get a weekend ticket and you can catch...
come and see me on Sunday morning, 10 o'clock, talking about George Orwell.
Who doesn't want
to... I need some people to come to that. 10 o'clock is not ideal on a Sunday morning.
It's kind of the graveyard shift at the
back. I'm up against some pretty good people as well.
But I'm sure it'll be very well attended. So, yes, please do come along. We will see you there. So, let's get into our agenda for today. One thing we wanted to start off with, Matthew, is mourning the departure of London's Night Czar. This is Amy LeMay. She's been in position since 2016. She was appointed by Sadiq Khan and has really become a kind of running joke, I think it's fair to say, because of the fact that there'd be constant reports about her huge salary. I believe at the time of her departure, it was £132,000 for 2.5 days a week. And yet during this period, London's nightlife had really taken a nosedive. It was particularly bad after COVID, but it was going in that direction beforehand anyway. What do you think the Night Czar's legacy will be as she steps down?
Look, I really think she's brought us all together. I think no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, the Amy LeMay meme has become such an extraordinary sign of a really just kind of leadership failure when it comes to London's nightlife. She was there for 8 years. I didn't realize it was 8 years. Mm. And she, between her BBC salary and her City Hall salary, she was earning more than both the Prime Minister and even Sue Gray.
Even Sue Gray,
she was earning more than. Quite extraordinary. I mean, there is a deeper sadness here, of course, about the state of nightlife in London in particular. The Times recently did quite an interesting analysis where they looked at closing times of bars and clubs in London and found that of the 12 largest cities in the UK, London is number 12. And you can say, well, maybe some of that's, you know, young people don't want to drink as much anymore. But I mean, there's no reason why we should think that young people who come to London don't want to drink. And it's because of all these factors we know. It's just licensing laws are ridiculous. They're not letting places stay open. There's obviously safety concerns, there's transport issues, and there's the cost of doing business because of all the taxes we keep putting on to people. It's just a really sad thing. And I think it's something embarrassing for London as a global city. This is what I feel the most, which is if you're in any other global city that's meant to be on, you know, we consider ourselves to be in line as a place to live, let's say New York. But if you want to get up anything at New York at 2 a.m. in the morning on a weeknight, you can. Everything is there for you all day and night. And it's just not the case in London. If you want to get a beer after 11 p.m., it's pretty much almost impossible.
And to put some more numbers to this, so between, this is, I suppose, telling a picture of how bad it's been going for quite some time now. So between 2001 and 2022, the number of pubs basically halved in the capital. Over the past 3 years, there was about 100 shutting every year. And as you were saying there, Matthew, this has been a particularly acute problem that, of course, nightlife has been hit by COVID and the lockdowns across the country. But there were plenty of analysis now pointing to the fact that London and its surrounding area have been hit the hardest, despite you thinking it would be a place that would bounce back very readily in the wake of the lockdowns. And then you think as well about what, okay, these things are going on. There's obviously bigger trends, economic policies being pursued and so on. But at the same time, what was she busying herself with? And you look into it and it seems like LeMay was spending her time pushing for LGBT murals in Vauxhall. There was a kind of nighttime trail that she was very keen on pushing and promoting in Greenwich. I'm not entirely sure what that had to do with anything. And also some sort of project around neurodiversity in Bromley. First of all, big skew towards South London here, which is slightly strange. But also, it does sort of sum up, I suppose, the warped priorities and also that kind of sense of, essentially, what is the point of these czars? Because we seem to live constantly under czars, as it were. There's a czar for nightlife, there's a czar for children's education, there's this and that, and yet nothing really seems to make any difference. Chris, I know you don't live in London. I know you're quite anti-London.
Never will, Tom.
What do you make of LeMay's departure?
Is it a real name for a start?
Or is it like a sort of stage name?
It sounds like a stage name. Do we know if it's a real name?
It's quite
a cool name for a cabaret star or something.
We should just call it Amy Lame. Just take the
Amy Lame.
I didn't want to say Lame by name, Lame by nature.
It would make a lot more sense. But it would make sense if it was a stage name because she's like a Radio 6 DJ as well. She looks like a Radio 6 DJ as well.
I suppose so.
And so it wouldn't surprise me if it was a stage.
Okay, well, I want to get that clear. secondly, you can see I know a lot about this. Czars were notoriously bad to live under. Why do these people always want to be referred to as czars?
Where did that come from? Yeah.
Well, Russia, presumably.
No, I mean like in recent times.
Who was the first czar? It was a Blairite thing, wasn't it? There was a drug czar. Mm-hmm. I remember that. Was there a school
for
czar?
Or against?
I don't know.
These kids aren't taking enough drugs.
Yeah, mostly against.
It's part of the kids these days. No sex, no alcohol, no drugs.
Mm. Yeah.
They don't drugs.
No nightclubs. I mean, she's obviously the epitome of the blob, isn't she, really? Like, when people talk about draining the swamp, I think it's people like her.
So there's the kind of thing where there could be almost a useful role if she used it productively. If she named and shamed the councils that are shutting down 200-year-old pubs because there's one resident who moved in 5 minutes ago complaining, if she called out Westminster Council for not allowing Greggs to open because it would attract antisocial behaviour. Yeah. There is.
It'd be a great job for one of us. We can really get into it. We can enjoy it, and people would like us.
Yeah, if you're willing to do something useful with it, it could be a valuable role. I mean, I don't see how it should be paid anywhere near that amount. Mm-hmm. But you know, if they're looking for a replacement, I'm more than available and willing to do that job.
No, absolutely.
They should have got Peter Stringfellow to do it while he was still alive. I think he would have been quite good.
Would fit the part of the Night Czar as well.
Yeah.
I feel like if there were such things as a Night Czar, you would want them.
But London is like. It's ridiculous how bad London is, to be honest with you, in terms of when people just getting a drink.
It's so
parochial, it's unbelievable.
When people visit, not just from abroad, but like other cities.
Market towns in Britain. Yeah.
And that was the thing that was about the Greg story that you were talking about, Matthew, which I think is so hilarious and revealing about this whole issue with licensing and the way that councils are blocking anything opening past a certain time. That Greg was on Leicester Square, I believe, and it wanted to be able to serve hot food, sausage rolls, whatever, till 2 o'clock in the morning. And yet this became a 2-year legal battle with Westminster Council over all of this because they said it was going to attract crime and antisocial behaviour. And you think, you know, you can get a Greggs at 2 o'clock in the morning in various cities in the north of this country. This is not a crazy imposition from anywhere else, but just something as simple as keeping a bakery open for late night, let alone a club or a
It is incredible because genuinely there is better nightlife in a lot of sleepy countryside market towns than there is in parts of London, Westminster in particular.
It's worth saying that this is also normally put in terms of the nightlife economy. Mm-hmm. And as much as I'm a fan of economics and there's a financial contribution here, really, I think this is much deeper in terms of like what we want to be as humans. Like we want to be social. We want to be able to go out and enjoy ourselves. We want to have that sense of like belonging and meaning and meeting other people. And that's all like slowly It's like this kind of social shaming that you dare go out and have a drink in the evening is underlying all this, that we should somehow, you know, all be in bed by that time and that it's a naughty behavior to be doing. And then the councils are kind of playing along with this in this very like puritanical way of trying to shut down one of the things that we're allowed to do for joy in our lives. And that seems like really quite disturbing to me.
Mm-hmm. Did you remember the Sydney lockout law controversy a few years ago?
I was
you were involved in it.
I was present and occasionally involved. It was more of a lock in actually. So it was you had to get into there by I think it was 1 a.m.
It was 1 a.m.
It was like 1 a.m. and then they actually I remember being in a club and they dramatically shut the doors at 1 a.m. and if you left you couldn't come back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then there were subsequent changes about what you could buy. So you couldn't buy a shot after 1:30 a.m. or something, and you could only buy a beer from 2 a.m. It was very, very nitpicky, and that was after a panic about nighttime violence. Mm-hmm. It kind of just people just relocated outside of the particular zone where they had these rules.
But even that, I think you couldn't go back in after 1 o'clock, but the club itself could open until 3 or 4, no problem.
Yeah.
I remember my Australian friends telling me about this. I was going, that doesn't actually sound that bad. You know, I could settle for that in parts of London right now, you know?
Mm.
So, yeah, every other city you ever go to, pretty much, it's even in Scandinavia, probably the closest to us and being uptight about these things. You can just get a drink until the guy who's serving you wants to close. Mm-hmm. That's just how it works. I was in Portugal a few weeks ago on holiday. I went to this bar that was only opening at 7 o'clock at night, you know? So we are the laughing stock of the world, I think, in this respect. George Orwell wrote some good stuff about this, getting on 100 years ago, about how ridiculous it is that you can go to France, go to Belgium, go to Spain, anywhere, and you just have a drink. And you carry on for as long as you want, and how this must put off tourists from coming to England, which it presumably does. Not to mention that obviously the price of the booze when you get to these places.
And Orwell is relevant here as well, because that was one of the controversies sort of as we were coming out of lockdown, which was the pub that was supposedly the basis for The Moon Underwater, his essay talking
there's
about
a few pubs lay claim to that.
There are many, but this is supposedly the one of two or three, which they claim was the inspiration for it, in Islington, the Compton Arms. And it was on the verge of being shut down because a load of people who'd moved to the area during lockdown were really upset that this pub was there. So when it reopened, the noise. This pub as well is a very kind of posh pub now. Like it brags about its small plates menu and is like, you know, half restaurant, half pub basically. If you can't take that, you know. On the end of
those street, people are the worst, aren't they? Who buy a house above a pub and they complain about it.
They're going to say the worst people are the people who eat small plates.
I don't like them.
They're up there as well. No, absolutely.
Is she going to be replaced or are they discontinuing the role now?
That's a very good... I mean, surely the smart move would be to quietly retire the position.
No, get somebody sounding to do it instead.
Are you volunteering?
Get Boris Johnson to do it.
There's a man who likes to be out after dark.
I don't know. There's loads of people who could do it and would really give it a shot. Yeah. It's quite an easy job. You just have to turn to meetings and have a go at the public health people who are saying, oh, we don't want to open this because it sells sausage rolls at 1 o'clock in the morning. It'd be a fun job to. I'm throwing my hat in the ring, basically. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. I am up for doing it.
I hate London.
Especially at that side. How much was it? 150,000?
It was about 135, I think.
Yeah,
I'm there. Packed up.
Call me if you're listening.
Listeners, please do start sending letters, start sending emails to City Hall campaigning for Chris to take over this role or revive the role if it has indeed been shelved.
Yep.
It's good money for 2.5 days.
Work is that it? 2.5 days? Oh my God.
I'm sure she was very much filling those out. While we're on the subject of crazy councils and licensing, Chris, I know you wanted to talk about this new fish and chip shop that's opening in North
Wales. I don't know if it is opening, Tom. That's the issue.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah.
Because this was it was on the BBC News website because it was so ridiculous. Even the people who work at BBC News realised this was crazy. So do you want to tell us a bit more about this battle for this chip shop to us?
This is one of the funniest stories of the year in a way, but also one of the most tragic. And it certainly sums up everything that's wrong with this country, which is Britain, because this happened in North Wales in a town that I can't pretend I can pronounce the name of. But it's a very small holiday destination, really. I think there's about 500 people live there. Obviously more in the summertime because it has a number of caravan parks and campsites and stuff. Quite Llandudno, I think. So it's, you know, the kind of people who like going on holiday to places like Wales or go to somewhere like this. And somebody has tried to open a new fish and chip shop.
Outrageous.
Yeah.
Can you believe them?
In a place like that.
They already have one fish and chip shop, but somebody wants
to... another one.
Another one. Yeah. Two doors down, in fact, from the existing fish and chip shop. And pretty much everybody who's paid a salary by the government is against this development. Starting with the acting public health director, whose name I can't remember, and I wouldn't mention her name anyway because I'm going to insult her by saying that she herself, judging by a photo, is no stranger to a Greggs. And I wouldn't mention something like that were she not complaining about food being served and going on about obesity, right? But she said, no, they can only open if they sell more fruit and veg. Right, well.
May I introduce her to the potatoes?
Fish and chip shop. Exactly. Firstly, chips are made out of vegetables.
Mushy peas.
Potatoes don't count to public health people because people quite like eating potatoes.
That's true, yeah.
So you can't have that. It has to be
null
stuff.
And void, yeah.
Yeah, it has to be green things that people don't like. But they are, whether she likes it or not, they are vegetables. So half the menu is vegetables. Fish is about the healthiest thing you can possibly eat. And battering fish is one of the cleverest things we ever did to get normal people to eat a lot of fish. Been a great boon to the nation's health, battering fish. You can always get well, certainly the places I go, you can usually get a pickled onion. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan myself, but the traditionists don't mind a pickled onion. And mushy peas, of course, I'm also not a fan of, but they are available and they are vegetables last time I checked. They don't do fruit, although I think some of them do battered pineapple, don't they?
Mm.
So even fruit's available.
Yeah.
But not enough for this woman who wants turnips and Swedes and broad beans and
garden like salad with
exactly order. Avocados probably. So she's not happy, so she's lodged a complaint, and then the local council got involved opposing it for a totally different reason, which is essentially that, well, they explicitly said there are already enough small businesses in the area.
It was worse than that. The exact quote was, there are too many small businesses.
Too many small businesses.
Which is probably what never knew existed.
Anyway, I went on the Wikipedia page of this town to try and find out where it is and how many people live there, basically. And it actually boasts on the main summary of the Wikipedia page that it has a fish and chip shop, a small supermarket, and a children's playground.
So they want some bigger businesses. Is that the problem? Is the business not large enough? Or they want a superstore there.
They don't want any businesses whatsoever.
Holding out for the Costco.
And then they said, we're worried about the amount of traffic that might flood into the place. I looked at it. The fish and chip shop is right on the very edge of town. Mm. The photo that the BBC used of this fish and chip shop has a sign in front of it saying, large car park to the rear. So it suggests to me that parking is probably not going to be an issue. And at the end of the day, it's only a fish and chip shop.
How many people?
It's not a multiplex cinema, is it? So it sums up everything that has stopped this country from growing and being happy for many, many years. Is this the local councils who just don't want anything built, plus public health people who don't want anything they don't like being built, and this axis of evil stopping the good people of this place that I can't pronounce having more than one fish and chip shop. It's unbelievable, really. But you're right, Tom. The BBC were laughing at this, saying things like, you know, it remains to be seen whether the people of North Wales actually do want fish and broccoli, you know. So at least the BBC has reached its limits.
Yeah. Who knew that they had such limits? Matt, what do you make of all of this?
It kind of struck me that at the heart of this is really a kind of like a misunderstanding of what drives like individual behavior. So there's an assumption here that the reason why people aren't having their fruit and vegetables is because the fish and chip shop doesn't sell it, rather than the appreciation that people go to a fish and chip shop because they want fish and chips. Mm. And even if that might not be the healthiest thing they can possibly ever eat, although according to dietitian Chris, that there could be... There are worse things you could eat. So what you get is this, kind of model in which individuals are manipulated by the stores and the shops that are available to them, rather than the stores and shops responding to what consumers want. Like, that's the very nature of it. There's a second fish and chips store potentially coming, because people want to buy more fish and chips that they've seen a spot in the market for, and they're being responding to that. It's the same kind of thing.
A holiday destination, just to say that again. Yes. This is a holiday destination.
It's the same kind of thing when you get this whole thing about grocery store deserts. It's like, oh, there's not a grocery store within 15 minutes walk of this particular destination. And therefore, you know, the evil big grocery is refusing to give these poor people access to fruit and vegetable. More likely what's happening is there's no market for it there. There aren't necessarily in that particular spot people who want to buy fish, who want to buy fruit and vegetables. And it's kind of the same principle here. It's like consumer behavior drives what commercial operations there are, particularly at that very micro level.
Mm-hmm. And exactly. And their belief is the opposite, that the availability creates the demand, and that people they struggle already to walk past one fish and chip shop. Expecting them to walk past two of them is really too much to ask. Have you seen the price of fish and chips recently, by the way? The idea that the locals in North Wales are going to be stuffing a vase with fish and chips every day. It's about, well, for three of us, including one child, it's best part of £30 fish and chips. And I live by the sea, where you'd think it'd be cheaper, but it never is.
And Chris, as we've been talking about a little bit, the claim is very much that it's the built environment, it's the mere presence of
availability.
Takeaways. Exactly. That's it's the availability. Word they use. Yeah. It's the obesogenic environment, which they say in the jargon. I think I know the answer to this question, but is there really any evidence that any of this is true?
I'm glad you asked me that, Tom, because I wrote a very interesting report some years ago in which I looked at all the evidence about whether, whether living near a fast food outlet or a junk food shop, whatever you want to call it, it means that people get fat. No, they don't. The evidence is very, very weak, to say the least, that there's any association. And that shouldn't be surprising, because firstly, you don't need to live near a takeaway because they do deliveries these days. And certainly a lot of these fast food joints are in the middle of city centres because that's where people go out drinking at nighttime and they want a kebab afterwards. And there are some people live in these city centres, and generally speaking, they tend to be poorer than average. And so you'll get this association, you know, oh, well, all the chicken shops are near where the poor people live. No, the chicken shops are there mainly for, you know, people who are going out on a night. So the people who actually live there in these supposed food deserts, or what Dimbleby calls food swamps, he's flipped it. He says, oh, it's a food swamp because you're swamped with kebabs and fish and chips and stuff. But no, they're not any more likely to be obese than anybody else. And really, why would they be?
Well, saying we do also have a solution to all this now. We don't
have
a
room.
Well, I was going to say we have the solution to obesity, which is Ozempic.
Oh, yeah.
Which these people hate more than anything else. They hate the idea of actually giving people the ability to take something that'll reduce the demand, the underlying demand for these shops. I mean,
obesity rates going down now in America. That's the big news. We should have talked about that.
Really. Yeah, obesity rates going down in America. And on top of that, some of the major kind of global food manufacturers have seen their stock prices go down because...
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, because, you know, companies like Mars, because the less expected consumption going down the track. If people are reducing their consumption by 10-15%, that means... reduce sales for some of these multinationals.
Yeah, it's like
massive market impact. So if you want to be the kind of anti-capitalist, anti-big sugar, you have to be pro-Ozempic, I think.
Short, big food.
Big food, big sugar. I love it. Everything has to be put big before it. But no, the other thing that was...
Huge.
do we imagine, Matt, that these things are going to get worse, is particularly this kind of crackdown on even just the availability of particular outlets? I mean, in recent years, I know that KFC have been fighting this kind of long-running legal battle. I think it's like over 40 councils they've been going to war with over their right to have a KFC in a particular locality. Do you see this getting worse, particularly as not just central government, but government in general have got really into this whole preventative health agenda, as they would call it?
And the sense is probably yes. So the new government is obsessive about its preventative public health agenda. They can't seem to actually do the policies that would fix the NHS and make it not the laughingstock of the world. So instead, they're trying to do policies to reduce, I suppose, consumer demand on the NHS, seeing people as a kind of a burden that needs to be gotten rid of. And this is indeed part of the national planning framework. You're meant to consider some of these factors. For example, if you're putting up a new food store, is it near a school? And therefore, it would be inappropriate for the school kids to potentially have access to this food, obviously ignoring the role of parents and diets and
just knock down the school. That's the way to solve these problems.
Yeah. Could KFC, you know, pay for the school to close? Maybe. So yeah, I think this is very much in Labour's agenda, and because unfortunately, quite consistently.
Carry on.
Because we're
I was just doing a subtle wave and it seemed to put Matt off his stroke.
Because we're definitely going to leave this in. I should describe it that Chris was signalling there to producer Lauren to go and fetch him more beer. And she had the temerity to be looking at her phone.
It's the last one. I think the listeners want to hear the sound of the beer being opened.
We're leaving this in. I don't... This is the behind the curtain.
It's not very professional to start laughing now, just because I was making a subtle hand gesture.
It wasn't so.
It's quite distracting, Chris. But I was mid flow.
In all fairness, she really wasn't on her game. So this is where were we, Matt?
We're talking about the government's public health agenda, prevention of public health agenda.
So it's going to get worse.
It's going to get much worse.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean, it seems quite obvious we're on a trajectory here with this government, a bit depressingly so. It's not going to work, so then they're just going to keep getting more and more extreme. Mm-hmm. That's why it's the same. We're going to be on this kind of inevitable downward trajectory. And, you know, I'm usually a little bit more optimistic than Chris, so that's not too hard being more optimistic than Chris.
So obesity is down, Chris. I didn't realize.
In America, yeah. It's actually gone down. Two years in a row, the stats guy at the FT was going big on this in a week.
Yeah, your man with his graphs.
Yeah, what's he called?
John
Burnham.
John Murdoch. John Burnham.
Sort of death pornographer.
You know what I mean. The COVID guy. Mm. He thinks that this has got to be Ozempic. There's nothing else really explains it. And I can well believe it. That's pretty cool, because no other country has ever, not deliberately at least, got obesity rates down.
There is also the good news that the NHS has done a big order of Manjaro, which is the kind of one of the alternatives, the more effective alternative to Ozempic, in fact.
More effective?
Yeah. It's
Is it cheaper?
I don't know how much.
Can the NHS afford this?
Well, apparently there's going to be millions of people on it over the coming decades. So we might even see reduced obesity here. Although then of course the problem is that they'll say they're silly kind of nanny status policies are the reason rather than the actual reason.
Does it still give you the squits or is that a fake news? I'm trying to work out.
Oh, there we go. Well, Matt's the man to ask.
He's not on it, let's be clear. That's up to you.
My personal medical history is none of your business.
But in theory, tell us about the squits.
I mean, there are known side effects to it.
As Boris Johnson alluded to.
Yeah, I mean,
has he been on it?
Yeah, no, I remember that was his first mail column.
He was on it.
Yeah.
I think there definitely can be side effects. If you try to overeat on it, you're going to feel a bit extra unwell, particularly as your body gets used to it. But I mean, nothing tastes better than skinny feels, as they say. Oh.
And it's definitely because of Ozempic, they reckon, in the US.
They can't prove it, can they? But there isn't anything else going on to make it. It hasn't just leveled off. It's actually gone down. You know? So it seems. It seems too much of a coincidence to not be that.
There you go. Chris, should we talk about minimum pricing?
Yes, please. It's
back in the news because in Scotland, they've put it up to 65p per unit.
Brutal. Oh, yeah.
I understand it was an attempt to kind of try and keep track with inflation, but do you want to tell us a little bit more about...
Well, it actually does. Yeah. This is kind of the scary thing. It shows how bad inflation's been. The 65p now is exactly the same as 50p in 2017. 30% higher. The pound has lost 30% of its value since 2017. That's bloody awful news if you're a saver, as people should be. So it has only gone up in line with inflation. So you might say, well, that's not that bad. But I think booze prices have managed to kind of keep below the rate of inflation. God bless the drinks industry. And of course, people's incomes haven't kept pace with inflation. So it will feel like more than a genuine rise. And you can kind of see that because the kind of drinks that are going to be affected now are much more in the sort of middle range than before. So at 50p a unit back in 2018, when minimum pricing came in, it really scuppered the white cider market. Mm-hmm. It scuppered the kind of supermarket own brand vodka market. And it might have made inroads into some of the cheaper brands, but it wasn't affecting things like Smirnoff. Yeah. This is affecting Smirnoff, right? So vodka now in Scotland cannot be, normal bottle, 70cl bottle of vodka, can't be sold for less than something like £17.20. Whereas you can get a bottle of Smirnoff, which is a decent brand, not premium, but a decent brand in England for 15 quid easily, if not less. So there's a tangible difference there. And the same applies to Famous Grouse, White & Mackay, Bell's, not the absolute top of the market, obviously, but, not scuzzy end of the market either, not the stuff that you would necessarily associate with.
There's nothing wrong with a Frosty Jacks or whatever.
Frosty Jacks is going up a lot, yeah. Frosty Jacks is now £2.50 a can. A can, not a big bottle, a can in Scotland. I can't believe people will still drink Frosty Jacks in Scotland. See, this is why I wanted to talk about this, because we all know it doesn't work. We all know it doesn't save lives. We've been through it before. What I'm interested in really is how it affects the market and what people switch to. So there must be some people still drinking Frosty Jacks in Scotland, even though it's £2.50 a can. And for £2.50, you can get something better, right?
But Chris, people's consumer preferences are variable. Maybe they enjoy them. Maybe.
Brand loyalty.
Well, they probably do. Fair enough.
And they're having a high enough income.
Sure. And maybe some of the premium brands aren't actually as good as people think. And maybe Bell's is actually better than Johnny Walker, whatever. Maybe it's all subjective.
Maybe it's all branding.
It's all subjective. Well, indeed. Yeah.
Not there's anything wrong with that.
Right. But let's say.
If you're a Frosty Jacks man, you're a Frosty Jacks man for life, I think.
Yeah. That may be true. But having said that, the bottom has really fallen out of the white cider market. So, there's not many people drinking Frosty Jacks, whereas before there were quite a lot, I think. But it's interesting to me how many people will stay loyal to a brand, even when it goes up in price a lot. So take Bell's, for example. Now, Bell's, I think most people would say, is not a particularly great whiskey. All right? I don't know if you're much of a whiskey drinker, Tommy, you're shaking your head. It's not great. I'm not having a go at it. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to alienate a potential future sponsor. But let's, it's towards the bottom of the middle range. Mm-hmm. And that now is only available £18 for a bottle, a normal 70cl bottle. For £18, you can get Johnny Walker Red, which I would say is a significantly better whiskey than that. So you would think, on that basis, that Bell sales are going to pretty much disappear, and stuff that used to be sold, stuff that's sold in England at £18, right, which is kind of, quote, worth £18, people will gravitate to that. I'd be interested to see if that actually happens, because it's quite possible a lot of people, you know, Bell's drinkers are listening to this going, rubbish, Snowden Bell's is absolutely brilliant and it's underpriced. And it is, of course, subjective, don't get me wrong.
Is it possible that some of it is just people buy to the price? So they actually don't know the brands that well. They're just now, because the price has gone up, they think that it's a more premium brand and therefore they're still buying it. Also, do we have any good kind of figures on whether or not the sales are down of those particular ones and people are just swapping to?
No, and I haven't seen the data on that, and I don't think it's publicly available, unfortunately. I would be very interested to see the data. And we know in broad strokes what benefit from minimum pricing the first time round. We know that cider went down. We know that port went up. We know that Buckfast went up. Mm-hmm. It's one of the brands we do know did really well because it was being sold above the minimum price to begin with. We know, I think, I've heard that brands like, let's say, Gordon's Gin, so kind of, again, mid-range, maybe towards the bottom, or the more affordable in the mid-range.
I put them at the bottom range myself. That's my particular gin preference.
I've enjoyed this, like, half-consumer review this.
Yeah. It's sort of, yeah, it's definitely...
You could definitely cheaper, do better than Gordon's, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, sure. But it's at the cheaper end without... Yeah, if you brought a bottle of Gordon's to party, people aren't going to go, bloody hell, you know, you could have got...
Leave.
Or maybe...
Honestly, yeah. Someone recently bought a bottle of Gordon's to my house party. I wasn't particularly impressed, to be honest. Okay. So you could do better than
that. Not impressed, but you might not have said anything.
I didn't say anything. I'm a very kind host. Yeah. Very kind
if they
host.
Bought one of them plastic boys from the Sainsbury's Basics, you might have. Yeah. You might have
well, we're seeing we're seeing how subjective it is. And a lot of this obviously is down to advertising. Mm-hmm. Yep. And people say, well, who's making out from minimum pricing? Somebody must be making the money, right? People are spending millions and millions of pounds more on alcohol. Who's making the money? And there is an argument from kind of pure economics that actually nobody's making the money because someone like Bell's or Gordon's will just spend loads more on advertising. So to try and maintain market share, but they won't make any more profit because they've spent it on advertising. And the bottom range gets kind of wiped out and people are buying more expensive drinks, but they're not just buying the old drinks at a new price, they're buying the better drinks at the kind of normal price, and those drinks cost more to produce. So actually no one's making any more profit. Mm-hmm. That's how it would work if everybody was totally rational. Whether it actually does work like that, I don't know. That's always a problem with economics. No one bloody rational.
Is minimum pricing as well the sort of quintessentially regressive policy, therefore? Because I know you've talked about how these kind of now mid-range products are finding themselves in range of the price floor, effectively, that's being put on these drinks. But when you zoom out, it is essentially we're going to make cheap drinks, therefore poor and work the sort of drinks and brands that poor and working class people tend to drink more expensive while leaving everything else.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, absolutely. It's just saying you can't buy cheap booze anymore. And I even had a few people on Twitter saying, well, I don't care. A bit like what you're saying, really, Matt. It's like, I don't care if Gordon's and Bell's get wiped out. People shouldn't be drinking them. They're rubbish. It's like, well, that's really none of your business. Do you know what I mean? If you're a student and you want to make your money go as far as it can so you can get as drunk as you can at a party and you're going to buy Tesco own brand whiskey, then more power to you. You should be allowed to do that.
I'm not saying that you shouldn't be allowed to buy Gordon's. I'm just saying you shouldn't be able to bring it to my house.
Yes, fair enough.
It's a wholly different point I'm making. That is my private property right there, and I would not be insulted by your Gordon's gin. I mean, there is a core point here, which is that ultimately, and remember, this is something J.S. Mill points out, which is that if you require the price of something to go up, you tax it. It is effectively a prohibition for those who can no longer afford to pay that price. It's just a prohibition on the margin. I mean, it is not considered to be a prohibitionist policy, but it is practically, if you actually are reducing alcohol consumption, admittedly, perhaps for a lot of people, they're not. They're just foregoing something else instead.
Yeah.
But to the extent to which it does reduce consumption, it is designed to be a prohibitionist policy.
Absolutely. Chris, unless you've got anything more on the minimum unit pricing, we should draw this to a close. But before we go, Matt, I know you've been on before, but we do ask this question of every guest. at the end of the podcast, which is if you had to have one band, what would it be?
Gin,
I can't remember what you chose last time. Could you remind me?
So last time I chose loud noises.
Just like, any type of loud
like,
noise.
Like motorcyclists revving as I'm trying to sleep in the evening. And I even had a method of dealing with it, which was sound-seeking missiles.
Yes, no, I remember.
You know, they have to apply it a few times. And it would work very effectively.
So a kind of iron dome for noise.
Correct. If the Israelis could give us iron dome, I'm sure they could give us this technology as well.
So what's your new selection?
So I think it's Slow Walkers.
Mm, yes.
Especially in Central
Chris
London.
On side immediately.
Often carrying large wheelie suitcases.
Correct. Well, it's worse when they're not, that's kind of like almost justifiable, but sometimes you're just walking down the street and they're just like, and then there's multiple. It's even worse when there's a line of them, you can't even walk past.
Yeah.
And you have to aggressively brush past them. Sometimes it's for the best just to, you know, do it in a more physical way, because you need to set a social norm that what they're doing isn't acceptable.
Acceptable,
yeah. So you need, in not too aggressive a way.
Not rockets.
This isn't assault, but this is just social norm creating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hate it, people. I mean, it's London, basically, especially at summertime, because it's tourists meandering around.
Americans.
Slugs. There's slugs getting in my way. And they're suddenly stopping. People who suddenly stop are even worse than people who walk slowly.
I think you could probably
train station, busy thoroughfares. We all know where we're going. Let's just walk as quickly as we can there. No. You've got people with a wheelie suitcase wandering around and then stopping, looking around, going, where are we? Looking at the phone. Get out of my way. Everyone in London, if you live in London, listen to this, get out of my way.
I don't think they live in London either. On holiday, Chris.
I also want...
Or if you're coming to London, anyone who's listening to this who lives or comes to London, get out of my way.
I think I also, as usual, I need an implementation method here.
Oh, good. Right,
I like this as like a sort of extra question.
Yeah, so I think in
snipers.
Practice, the way...
It'll get very violent. Anyway.
Okay, I was thinking a bit more moderate, but now you've said that.
What's the more moderate option? What's the third way?
Third way. Call me a Blairite. I think at entry points, you should be required to do kind of a test to see how fast you can walk. So you put you on a treadmill, and if you can't make up a certain speed, then it's like, imagine at the border, you know, you go through the e-gate, then you know, you put in your passport, then the next step is you have to show you can walk enough to enter London.
Yeah, the next steps, quite a lot of steps. There for a few minutes, let's have a go. But that, yeah, I mean, I like your style, but just because people can walk fast doesn't mean they do.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So I think we're back to snipers.
Or something snipers.
And I apologise to our listeners for that explicitly ableist screed that we heard there from Matthew. But no, it's one of those things where, at the same time, what you can do, just stop anyone who can't, like old people can't come into the country or London or...
Okay, I haven't thought this through.
Okay, right.
You're asking too many detailed questions.
I think we're back to the snipers then. Anyway.
I don't think we need old people or children in London. Certainly not central. Not in the bits,
it's just not
the
necessary. Maybe as well that you could, if you can't walk a certain speed, you're restricted from places or times that are busy. You can walk slow. Also, maybe there's a rule you have to walk single file so people can overtake you.
I see. Yeah.
You could have some I'm open to compromise. Yeah.
Lanes?
I see few children in London, like in our bit of London, where, you know, Westminster basically.
Yeah.
I'm always like shocked and appalled when I do see a child, which is usually in the summertime. And like children as young as 2 or 3. On the tube with their parents. Like, what are you doing here? Nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants. I wouldn't take my child to London when we're 2 or 3. I barely do it now. It's not a suitable place for a child.
So eventually you're going to let them experience the world.
But they're not going to remember anything. You can show them around Buckingham Palace.
Children do live here.
They won't remember anything like
that. Children do live here as well, don't they? But
not in the middle of Westminster.
No, that's true. No. Sorry, yeah.
I don't mean the whole London, obviously. I'm not an idiot. You know? in the suburbs, whatever. Obviously, you have, you know, have children, raise them, and just don't bring them.
Should we have age gating?
Don't bring them on the tube to Westminster. It's odd, very weird when people bring small children to London. No one's enjoying that. The parents aren't enjoying it. The children aren't enjoying it. The children won't remember it, so it's pointless. Just stay at home. In general, listeners, if you're having children, if you think of having children, don't try and do anything with them until they're at least 8 or 9, because they won't enjoy it, they won't remember it, and it'd be a really bad experience. In particular, do not bother going on a foreign holiday. Everyone hates you on the airplane. Yeah. If you've got a baby or a toddler, no one wants to see it. If you look at parents with small children on airplanes, both the father and the mother look in hell. The baby's just screaming, couldn't care less what's going on. But both the parents look awful. They're having a very miserable time because they are. And all the people around them on the plane, mm-hmm. possibly every single person on the plane, is pissed off with them for being there. So who wins from this scenario? Don't do it. Just accept once you have children, your life's over for a few years. Don't live in the past and think you can just carry on doing things. Oh, I'm going to go to the pub. And all. No, don't. Stay at home. Wait for them to grow up. And then
save lives.
Very gently start doing things again.
I'm coming soon to Spiked, a new podcast by Chris Snowden.
Yeah, parenting.
How to be the best parent.
Parenting with Snowy.
I would definitely listen.
I've got some good tips, listeners.
And on that very helpful note, we should probably close. But Matt, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.